Hi everyone, this is Fahim Nurali, Climate Finance Trade Commissioner based out of the Embassy of Canada in Washington, D.C. This is the final session of the Climate Finance Roundtable, which was held in late May. And this session, I feel, pulls it all together because it focuses on policy, and policy specifically from the U.S. and Canada toward climate finance in emerging markets. This session actually follows the April 22nd summit put together by President Biden, where a climate finance plan or initiative was announced and a roadmap was introduced. So in this session, we have representatives from the Department of Treasury in the U.S. and the Development Finance Corporation in the U.S. to talk about how climate finance will look like under the Biden administration going into COP. We will also have introductory remarks from Patricia Fuller, Canada's Climate Change Ambassador, and from Sue Sabo from Global Affairs Canada. Collectively, this conversation really reflects on the challenges and opportunities in climate finance going forward. So I hope you really get to learn about how policy can really make a difference in making a project investable. There were some technical difficulties when we taped this session, and we've tried to edit it out. So if there are any skips in the audio, this is why. Enjoy it, and please let me know if you have any comments. Thanks. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the virtual Climate Finance Roundtable. My name is Fahim Nurali, and I am the Climate Finance Trade Commissioner based out of the Embassy of Canada in Washington, D.C. Today is the last day and the last session we're having in this series. As I mentioned over the last couple of days, the purpose of this series is to gain a deep insight into project financing in emerging markets, of course, with an emphasis on climate resilient and adaptive projects. Overall, we have tried to address the following question in the four sessions of this series. If there's so much money in climate finance, what does it take to get deployed? In our first two sessions, we focus on the supply and demand of capital in climate finance. The investors on our panel, which included leaders at FinDev Canada, IDB Invest, and the International Finance Corporation, talked about what an investable project should look like and how investors should approach opportunities in emerging markets. They noted that they are keen to invest in projects that are financially viable and speak to the impact priorities, such as climate and gender, which have been impressed upon them by the policy objectives of their donors, such as the Canadian and American governments. It's important to be patient, they say, as the conversations that they have with companies and with platforms are more lead to relationships, that which then lead to partnerships. Following session, where a Canadian project developer, JCM Power, and a Canadian impact investor, Deakin Impact, both of whom have strong partnerships with the IFIs, shared best practices in their approach. Not surprisingly, there was an emphasis on team, ensuring that the climate and gender interests are well integrated into the plan, and making sure that you have management buy-in. The role of technical assistance to companies, as well as having local capabilities, is important both from the investment platform and project development perspective, that the development of these TA facilities and these programs come from policy. Yesterday, we had an engaging conversation during our innovative finance panel about the potential for blended finance to help close the supply and demand gap in climate finance. All of the panelists, who are world-renowned experts in blended finance, included Convergent Blended Finance, IDB Invest, IFC, and the UK government. They were very clear to emphasize that blended finance is not a subsidy or grant, and a project that has blended finance in its structure must be financially viable. That being said, blended finance plays a catalytic role in climate finance, and going into COP26 at Glasgow later on this year, blended finance will be, quote, front and center, as our UK panelists put it. The reason is that because blended finance has allowed greater investments in the most vulnerable countries and nascent sectors, areas which climate finance policy is focused. All of the optimism around climate finance is only enabled by strong climate finance policy coming from donors and MDB board members. Both the US and Canada play significant roles at the World Bank, IDB, and many other IFIs, and both the Development Finance Corporation and FinDev Canada have been active in financing a pipeline of investments and platforms. I'm really excited about our panel today as they reflect the intelligence and passion around setting policy for better climate finance flows. We will start with introductory remarks from Canada's Ambassador for Climate Change, Patricia Fuller, and then we'll engage in a discussion with our panel. And now I'd like to invite Ambassador Fuller to provide her remarks.
Thank you, Fahim. And it's a real pleasure to be part of this Climate Finance Roundtable series. And congratulations to you, Fahim, and to the Canadian Embassy in Washington for this initiative and for pulling together such a great group of speakers in the past couple of days. And for this session, I thought I would make a few remarks about the policy context for climate finance. So first off, to note that the science is clear. We know we have to achieve net zero emissions by 2050 to hold global warming to 1.5 degrees and avoid the most catastrophic effects of climate change. And certainly here in North America, the costs of climate change are already in evidence with increased incidence of hurricanes, wildfires, flooding, drought, and many other climate impacts. But developing countries who have contributed the least to greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere are in many ways most exposed, with the least capacity to bear these burdens. So it's in this context that the Paris Agreement committed parties to bring nationally determined contributions, or NDCs, to reduce emissions and to enhance adaptive capacity. And it was in this context that developed countries committed to assisting developing countries in responding to climate change. So 2021 is a critical year to make progress on these goals through the G7, the G20, and the COP26 process. And important progress has been made already. As of the Earth Summit hosted by President Biden, all of the G7 are now committed to targets for reducing emissions that are aligned with what is needed to hold global warming to 1.5 degrees. And this includes Canada having committed to a 40 to 45% reduction in our emissions relative to 2005. But more emission reductions, more commitments are needed from more countries in advance of COP26 to get us closer to what is required to meet this temperature goal and keep that 1.5 degree goal in reach. And the UK presidency, supported by Canada, the US, and others, are working together to encourage more countries to strengthen their NDCs and come forward with bolder emission reduction commitments. Just last week, G7 environment ministers called on all countries, in particular major emitting economies, to enhance their NDCs ahead of COP26. And the second key priority in these processes is increasing climate finance. And G7 environment ministers last week reaffirmed their commitment to the goal of mobilizing $100 billion annually in support for developing countries through to 2025 from a wide variety of sources, both private and public. And both Canada and the US have indicated our intentions in this regard, and more will be said about this during today's panel. It's of note that G7 ministers underlined the important role of innovative financing vehicles and blended finance, as well as the all-important enabling policy environments for the goal of scaling up private sector financing. Ministers also recognized the potential of carbon markets for fostering cost-efficient emission reductions and the importance of ensuring environmental integrity in carbon market mechanisms. Beyond advancing ambition on NDCs and increasing climate finance, the UK as COP president is leading important work that Canada is participating in to drive emission reductions globally in key sectors. And of course, the energy sector, as the source of around 3/4 of global emissions, is the most critical of these. And earlier this month, the IEA roadmap was released, and this shows that the rate, for example, just in terms of the scale of transformation required, the rate of energy efficiency improvements has to triple and the rate of expansion of renewable energy needs to quadruple. Electrification is a crucial tool, as well as batteries, hydrogen, and carbon capture use and storage, if we're to achieve the 2050 goal. And these transformations will and are enabling the phase out of unabated coal power. And that needs to happen by 2030 in advanced economies and by 2040 everywhere to meet emission goals. The Powering Past Coal Alliance, which Canada leads with the United Kingdom, is playing a leadership role in advancing the need for coal power phase out. Public finance will be critical to this energy transition, especially in developing economies, but ultimately most of the investment will need to come from private sector sources. And mobilizing this kind of capital calls for very close cooperation between developers, investors, public financial institutions, and governments. And to this end, the work towards COP26 has included a number of country-level dialogues under the auspices of the Energy Transition Council. And these are intended to advance this kind of cooperation. It's clear that we need to accelerate implementation of projects. So the kind of practical conversations that have happened this week in these climate finance roundtables are very important. And ultimately, energy transition must be for and about people. And integral to the IEA scenario is providing electricity to the 785 million people globally who don't have it, and clean cooking solutions to 2.6 billion people. It also implies the creation of 14 million new jobs, according to the IEA estimate, globally by 2030, thanks to new investment in clean energy. So this is a huge opportunity for all of our economies. Apart from energy, nature is also another area that will play a significant role in the pathway to net zero emissions by 2050. And this was recognized by G7 ministers who underlined the importance of nature-based solutions in delivering significant benefits, not only for climate mitigation, but also adaptation. As well as the co-benefits they carry for biodiversity and people contributing to achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals. Ministers committed to strengthening the deployment and implementation of nature-based solutions and increasing the quantity of finance for nature and for nature-based solutions. And within this global collaboration on climate change, Canada and the United States are committed to working very closely together. And we have created a high-level ministerial dialogue on climate ambition, which is aimed at increasing our shared ambition for emission reduction and adaptation. And included in this dialogue is a working group on international cooperation, which will be a very useful forum for coordination as we both move forward with increasing our climate finance. So with that, thanks very much for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm looking forward to listening to the panel, and I'll pass it back to you, Fahim.
Great. Thank you so much, Ambassador Fuller. I think you brought up some really great points, particularly around, you know, the role of public finance, but private. We need much more private finance, and then focusing on the sectors. And I think I had watched an appropriate something on YouTube, the where Congress was interviewing witnesses, we can go into a little bit later, from DFC, Treasury, and others, where they've hit among a lot of the same points that you did, and why this is so critical for developing countries who are taking an unfair burden to climate change and have the least amount of capacity to deal with it. So this has created a great context for our conversation. I look forward to an engaging discussion where we get a better sense of climate finance policies in the US and Canada and what it means for the international finance institutions. So with that, I want to introduce our panel, and I'll have them introduce themselves in the order. So first, Dr. Sue Sabo, who is the Director General at Global Affairs Canada for Innovative and Climate Solutions. Then Ms. Elizabeth Lean, Director for Office of International Development Policy at the U.S. Department of Treasury. And lastly, Ms. Aparna Srivastava, the newly appointed Deputy Chief Climate Officer with the Development Finance Corporation. So Dr. Sava, we'll start with you.
Thanks very much, Fahim. And let me start by echoing the thanks and the congratulations to you and the Embassy of Canada for really putting on this series, which by all accounts has set the bar high for this panel. And you've already got some really interesting insights, I guess. And I'm really pleased to also be part of this panel in the context of the renewal of the partnership between Canada and the US on climate, on nature, and on biodiversity. And as you mentioned, I'm the Director General for Climate Finance here in Canada. Now, Canada has announced that we will be making a new commitment to international climate finance in the months leading up to COP. And that means that I don't have any details on either the policy or the funding envelope for that new commitment. So what I'm going to do is make a few remarks about key elements and what we've learned from our $2.65 billion commitment that we're just completing and how this positions us for moving forward. First of all, when we made that commitment of $2.65 billion in 2015 in Paris, it was in the context of an overwhelming global concern about temperature. And there was a big focus, therefore, on mitigation as a tool to make sure that we don't have the kind of temperature rises that we're so concerned about. And it also was in the context of making sure we incentivize the private sector towards a low carbon pathway. And this focus on mitigation, we really did help achieve our own goals then that we set in terms of Canada's commitment to contributing to global greenhouse gas reductions. And so this is really important still for us to make a global contribution in this effort. Secondly, with mitigation as our goal, our main tool ended up being loans. You earlier talked about blended finance as well. Now, what this means is that at that point, and I would say it's still true now, we have little or even no scope for direct investments, given the nature of how we work, particularly for small transactions. But what it did mean was that we created or we worked through investment platforms and fund managers, particularly in the international financial institutions. And what I'd like to emphasize with that is that our climate finance, even our loan portfolio, falls within our feminist international assistance policy. And particularly, we looked at how we could include an emphasis on gender equality in all our climate finance. Okay, so what I'd like to do just as a final remark is to briefly highlight one of the key challenges we see moving forward. And it's really at the intersection of the supply of and the demand for funding. And as I think it was noted in some of the earlier roundtables, there's actually a need for larger and pooled funding in the amounts of hundreds of million dollars needed from donors to help crowd in capital from larger institutional investors. And in fact, this is something that we are also now discussing with our US counterparts. But then on the other side, we're also thinking about how such larger pooled funds and our other funds more generally could actually also support smaller companies with innovative ideas and who might be more nimble. For example, we know that Canadian companies have been leaders in the clean tech space. So as we look forward to Canada's next funding envelope for climate finance, we really welcome forums like this for ideas on how Canada can continue to innovate, particularly with our loan financing. Thank you.
Great, thank you so much for those remarks. I'd like to turn it over to Elizabeth to introduce the Department of Treasury and herself as well to follow up on those remarks.
Thanks so much, Fahim, and it's really a pleasure to be here. So in January, the Biden-Harris administration called for the US government to prepare a climate finance plan focused on international climate finance. The administration is embracing ambitious but attainable goals regarding the quantity of public climate finance provided by the United States, recognizing the urgency of the climate crisis by addressing the sharp drop in U.S. international climate finance during the 2018 to 2021 period. The United States intends to double by 2024 our annual public climate finance to developing countries relative to the average level during the second half of the Obama-Biden administration. And while this public climate finance goal is ambitious, it is in the face of a daunting climate crisis that requires not only ambitious public financing goals, but also cooperation from the private sector and global partners, especially our close allies like Canada. At Treasury, we're focusing on a broad range of climate-related domestic and international policy work connected to climate finance, climate-related economic and tax policy, and climate-related financial risks. Simply put, Treasury is focused on mobilizing finance for climate mitigation and climate adaptation, supporting the broader alignment of the financial system with a path to net zero emissions by mid-century. We see this as a global economic opportunity to help countries tackle the climate challenge while also reorienting their economies toward the fast-growing low-carbon sectors. As part of the strategy, we have created a new climate hub at Treasury, which I joined this week. The climate hub will coordinate and enhance our existing climate-related activities by harnessing the tools, capabilities, and expertise from across the department and enable us to move nimbly and efficiently in prioritizing climate action. We look forward to identifying new, innovative, and impactful programs in the multilateral climate finance sphere. This includes efforts like the Accelerating Coal Transition Program at the Climate Investment Funds, which holistically assesses community needs for a just transition. It incentivizes needed reforms on the part of governments and assists in decommissioning or repurposing existing coal facilities. We are also working to do more with our existing multilateral tools. This includes working closely with Canada in the G20 context to develop indicators for sustainable infrastructure to answer and expand investor demand for climate-aligned projects. At the multilateral development banks, we will help ensure, in partnership with shareholders, that those institutions set and apply ambitious climate finance targets and policies to their operations and programming. Treasury will seek to have the MDBs build on the significant levels of climate finance they already provide by promoting a strong role for the MDBs in supporting developing countries' efforts to implement their climate commitments, to strengthen country NDCs, or nationally determined contributions under the Paris Agreement, and to integrate greenhouse gas reduction and climate resilience into their long-term strategies. Engaging with the MDBs to prioritize the adoption of methodologies and policies that will accelerate their full alignment with the goals of the Paris Agreement is important, and Treasury will engage with other MDB shareholders to forge consensus for full Paris Agreement alignment. By working through the MDBs alongside efforts from government agencies like DFC, who's represented here today, USTDA, Millennium Challenge Corporation, USAID, and others, the U.S. is opening important opportunities for the private sector and catalyzing opportunities for new investment in both climate change mitigation and climate change adaptation. Further, the United States Treasury Department will engage with bilateral partners through climate-focused policy dialogues and technical assistance to help governments mobilize private sector financing for high-quality infrastructure development, incorporating economic, environmental, social, and governance standards consistent with the G20 principles on quality infrastructure investment. Many thanks.
Thank you so much for those remarks, and I'm glad that you mentioned Treasury's role with the MDBs and working with them to meet the climate commitments. I'd like to introduce Aparna as well. Aparna was just confirmed as the Deputy Chief Climate Officer at the Development Finance Corporation, which is a new role. So Aparna, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Fahim. I'm grateful to be a part of this important conversation. And building off of kind of the really important and engaging remarks that we've heard from the other panelists today, I just want to iterate, I want to kind of emphasize where our thinking is coming from as the DFC and some of the commitments that we have made already in this regard. So climate finance really is an important tool for mobilizing the significant resources that will be needed to confront one of the biggest challenges our world faces. President Biden has appropriately described climate change as the existential threat of our time and called on DFC to use its climate finance tools to support mitigation, adaptation, and resilience around the world. Many places, as we know and has been covered already, are suffering from the impacts, the devastation from climate change already, which is why resilience and adaptation are an integral part of our approach to climate finance. So our DFC's tools include loans, guarantees, equity, political risk insurance, feasibility studies, technical assistance, and support for emerging market private equity funds. On April 22nd, DFC announced a bold climate strategy that includes many commitments, including achieving a net zero portfolio by 2040 and focusing one third of our new investments in climate by 2023. We've also named, as has been communicated, not only the Deputy Chief Climate Officer, but a Chief Climate Officer for the first time in the agency, and announced calls for application for investments in distributed renewable energy and climate-focused funds. Along with this, we've also launched a $50 million technical assistance fund specifically focused on building up a pipeline of investment-ready climate initiatives. The broad scope of this plan reflects the scale of work and the breadth of work we intend to engage in. And while our commitments might sound bold, they are defendable based on careful accounting and credible assumptions. So in terms of how we intend to achieve these bold commitments, we have three key areas of work we will be pushing forward. One is building up a portfolio of flagship climate investments that demonstrate not only our strategic, but our climate commitments around the world. Second is to mobilize capital. As has been also underscored by other speakers today, we need all hands on deck, right? So we will be working to mobilize private sector capital and also capital from other financing institutions. And finally, we will work to trailblaze on adaptation and resilience investments. So with that, I'll pause and we can ensue in our discussion.
Great, thank you, Aparna. And I think, like you said, it's really exciting that your role and the Chief Climate Officer's role has now been established and underscores the US commitment to climate as an existential threat. So I'd like to invite all of our panelists and Ambassador Fuller to join me with the cameras on if you can. And I think I'll start actually with Elizabeth and Aparna and then turn over to Ambassador Fuller and Sue. You know, we've talked about climate finance and what it means to you, but there's so many definitions as to what climate finance is and what climate finance isn't. So from the DFC perspective and the Treasury perspective, what would you want people to know about how you're looking at defining climate finance? And I'll then ask that question to Ambassador Fuller and Sue as well. So Aparna, over to you.
Sure. So I think for us, climate finance is really anything that is helping address climate change. Now, previously, this has often been connected and thought of as solely climate, clean energy and renewable energy, often in the mitigation side of things. But for us, we're really trying to broaden that to also include a variety of other sectors. So climate finance, I think, is just really anything whether it is through clean energy, food security, nature-based solutions, it's really kind of a wide range of issues. So financing that's supporting the development of projects in those sectors.
Great. Elizabeth?
Yeah, thank you. I think I really liked, Aparna, what you said about it. These are defensible numbers. They are based on a lot of analysis. And I think that's key. You know, the multilateral development banks have spent a number of years trying to answer this very question, to look specifically and sort of have a collective way of defining climate finance. The intention, of course, is to make sure that it is a consistently used term, and that these are numbers that are defensible. So absolutely, things like clean energy investment, that is absolutely climate finance. And on food security, there could be an element that is climate finance. You know, there's sort of these accounting techniques to make sure that we're not overcounting, but we're not undercounting, because the reality is that climate finance should likely be incorporated into a broad swath of development assistance. So that's something that we sort of have been engaging with the multilateral development banks over a number of years to understand their system.
Ambassador Fuller, from your perspective, how would you define climate finance? Because I know you're involved with policy all over the world. So how does climate finance defined when you're looking at policy objectives?
Well, I'm going to let Sue provide the official Government of Canada answer as the woman who administers our climate finance. But I will just say that the question's important from the perspective of two things. One is that certainly we can say that as we make our way down the path to net zero emissions and the significant transformation that implies throughout our economies, that any investment should be supportive of that transition and climate consistent. However, and this is the second point, your question matters from the perspective of making good on the commitment of developed countries to developing countries. And so from that perspective, climate finance has a special definition, if you will, for the purpose of accounting for how we're making good on that commitment. But let me turn to Sue for the official word on this.
So certainly agree with the previous speakers. So let me just try to add a couple of points here. One is obviously that the UNFCCC definition really matters, and also the Rio markers really matter for how we count and what we include in our counting of climate finance. And I think that's really important in terms of establishing trust and establishing credibility in our numbers. The other point I would make, you know, is that such definitions are not neutral in the sense that we also, as we've been discussing here, have policy overlays on these definitions, other things we want to be able to achieve. And I've emphasized earlier that for us, our feminist international assistance policy is really critical in terms of where we direct climate finance to, an emphasis on the vulnerable, the poor, and gender equality. So I think for us, that becomes an additional element that we're considering in terms of climate finance as well. But again, that is an addition to the definition for us. And then finally, I think the other reason for the UNFCCC definition as being important is we all want to try to demonstrate that our climate finance is additional. And again, I think that's really important for global efforts on climate finance and really trying to establish that trust between developed and developing countries.
That really helps provide some context to this conversation. Sue, I'm gonna stick with you and then turn to Elizabeth on how, you know, it was mentioned earlier in multiple comments that collaboration is important and coordination is important. So how are US and Canada coordinating around reaching climate finance objectives?
So first of all, let me start by reiterating how pleased we are of renewing this partnership with the US and really starting down the road to look at additional ways in which we can collaborate. I think Ambassador Fuller mentioned earlier on about the renewed Canada-US partnership, the roadmap, as well as the high-level ministerial dialogue. And I think those set a really important framing for what we're going to be doing, not just on climate, but also on biodiversity and nature. And I think Elizabeth also mentioned the accelerating coal transition effort as one of the key efforts globally to try to really address this important element of weaning ourselves off coal. And that certainly, I think, is one of the concrete aspects of how we can take these higher level agreements and start looking at where are some of the programming opportunities, where are some of the key initiatives where working together could really help us go to scale and address those kind of global threats.
Elizabeth, I'd love to get your perspectives as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I fully agree with Sue. And I think I would just augment a little bit that, you know, there are opportunities sort of in some more formal and some more informal settings. Obviously, the United States and Canada engage very, very closely in the G7 processes, the G20 processes, but also as fellow members of institutions, whether that's at the Multilateral Development Bank boards, Green Climate Fund boards. You know, these are important institutions where having you know, a friend sitting next to you sort of engaging on these issues as you go along is really important. And I would also say increasingly so, I think we are trying to make sure that it's clear that we are not duplicating efforts in third country areas, right? So our bilateral engagement, we want to make sure that it complements any sort of engagement that Canada might be doing, but isn't duplicating efforts. It may complement what the multilateral institutions are doing, but not duplicate what they're doing. So that's just one note. Thanks.
Looking at some of the geographic and thematic areas where the U.S. and Canada wants to focus, you know, Sue had mentioned the feminist international feminist policy. From the U.S. perspective, what are two or three key priority sectors or themes that the U.S. government would like to see its climate finance go to? So that question is to you, and then to Aparna from the DFC perspective.
To me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So clearly, I think, you know, the United States is ready to focus its efforts on partner countries that are willing to engage, right? So I think it is potentially less about, you know, the United States absolutely wants to engage in X region, but it is more about, is that country government willing to make the commitments that are necessary to make the large transitions? The coal transition is a big one example there. You know, there are a number of countries that are very reliant on coal. But if there is not sort of the important political will to make the needed changes, that might not be our top tier priority country, right, to engage. As far as other sectors and themes, I mean, gender is absolutely important. I would say the Biden-Harris administration has also really prioritized LGBTQI+, and that, you know, in general development work, in climate specifically, you know, other underserved groups, this is important to not just think about GHG emissions, but how those investments are made in an equitable fashion.
Aparna?
Yeah, and to add, thank you. Yes. So to add to that from the DFC perspective, you know, as the Development Finance Corporation, our focus is specifically on the developing world with a strong focus on low and lower income countries. And so as Elizabeth said, there isn't a single particular country that we're wanting to prioritize, but really kind of these broader regions and figuring out how we can be, you know, most effective in our support. With regards to, you know, thematic priorities, the DFC is a part of the 2X challenge. So really trying to prioritize the investments that are in, you know, women-owned, women-led businesses around the world. And, you know, sector-wise, it's, I alluded to this previously, but, you know, like DFC actually has a very sizable portfolio of investments in renewable energy. We have also had some investments already in agriculture and agricultural insurance, for example. But what we're looking to do when we're thinking about climate finance is really to try to think of it as a portfolio approach, right? So building up a broad portfolio of investments across sectors, because when ultimately that the reality is that climate change is impacting pretty much every sector out there in some form or another, but really figuring out how we can make sure that it is genuinely value add with regards to the impacts on mitigation and adaptation targets. So in terms of, you know, broader sectors that you know, I want to make sure that we're looking at as, you know, as DFC's climate leadership, you know, moving beyond and including clean energy, of course, but moving into areas of e-mobility, public transport, food security and agriculture, as I mentioned, but of course, also looking at issues around water access and stewardship, coastal resilience, waste management, land use change, and nature-based solutions. So this might sound, you know, quite broad, but I think it's important to kind of really emphasize that when we're thinking about, you know, investing in addressing climate change, we are very much committed to looking beyond just mitigation practices, as important as they are. The impacts are already being felt, and so really trying to bolster these other sectors is quite important to us as well.
No, thank you for that. Canada and the US deploys climate finance through the MDBs and through the International Finance Institution. Ambassador Fuller, could you comment on how this helps climate change overall by working with the MDBs? And then Sue, I'd like you to comment on when we've deployed funding, let's say to the C2F2 or to the Canada Fund, Climate Fund with the IFC, how has that really helped forward climate objectives? So Ambassador Fuller, I'll start with you.
Well, there are a number of advantages to working through the multilateral development banks, and those advantages have led Canada to be to have quite a large share of our climate finance be channeled through the MDBs. So some of those advantages are more, I would say, at the level of implementation of projects and the assurances that working through MDBs provides. But I think another important aspect that I think we're going to be thinking about going forward, and it alludes just to something that Elizabeth was saying as well, is working through the MDBs does strengthen donor coordination. And as we think about making these difficult transitions in all of these countries that you know need to be get moving off coal and rapidly expanding renewable energy and so forth, the level of coordination required is very high among donors and host governments and as I was saying earlier, developers, et cetera. So working through MDB funds that have the capacity to finance large projects and large initiatives is certainly a plus. But that said, there's of course the advantages to the bilateral channel as well. But let's hear from Sue on this point too.
Thanks. And I think we're going to complement each other quite nicely on this, Patricia, because Canada has participated in organizations both as a core donor as well as some of these bilateral funds. And I'll speak specifically then to the bilateral funds because Fahim, you raised that. So one of the key advantages in terms of some of these bilateral initiatives that we've put funding into with the MDBs is that we've really been able to advance some of our key policy goals. We were talking about gender equality and inclusion before those started to become more mainstreamed across the climate finance dialogue, which actually meant there were some really uncomfortable conversations early on with the MDBs. There was a lot of nudging and a lot of like really looking for where we could advance things in a certain space, changing policies, changing norms. So I think that becomes, you know, one of the things I would say was one of the key advantages. Now, of course, one of the less, or the one on the con side, perhaps, is this whole issue about being able to achieve scale. And what Patricia just talked about on donor coordination, for example. So how do we find potentially the best of both worlds, where our support to the MDBs can push forward on new areas of policy? And you know, I think we've all been talking here about how dynamic the world of climate finance is. How do we push forward on some of those dynamic areas with our MDB counterparts? But also then, how do we try to take advantage of some of these synergies that we could get by stronger donor coordination on issues around policy and on issues around countries that really need to be showing, as Elizabeth was emphasizing, the political will that's shown through policy change and regulatory change.
Great. Thank you. Aparna, my next question is to you, and it's along the similar lines. When you're looking, or DFC is looking at investments overall, when you're applying the climate lens, what is the trade-off between impact and financial viability? Or is there a trade-off? Is that a false trade-off? I'd love to get your sort of thoughts on that.
Great. Yeah, it's an important question. And I think, you know, as we have come into existence as the DFC from our predecessor agency as OPIC, this has been a really important question. Because we've been wrestling with a similar question on our emphasis on development impact and financial return for several years now. And so I think, you know, we are really committed to addressing climate impact in a way that is sustainable financially, of course, and as much as possible. So I guess the short answer here is that I don't have a clear clear line or, you know, a clear percentage of return. What we do recognize is that it is very project specific, right? In certain countries where if there is an investment that would be providing, you know, a large amount of the population access to certain services that they would not have had otherwise. Of course, if that means taking a lower rate of return, that's something that we absolutely have to be able to consider. And I think the framework of evaluation that we have developed, the impact quotient, is one that actually is a method that we use to screen each of our investments to understand what is the development impact, what is the financial considerations, and how that can be balanced. And one of the key jobs we have on our desk as the chief and deputy climate officers is really working to integrate these metrics and methods of assessment specifically for climate impact, right? So whether it is on the mitigation or adaptation side of things, really figuring out what are the key targets that need to be achieved, and you know, what potential trade-offs, which I agree with your rewording of the question, because I don't think it is always a matter of a trade-off there, but you know, what are the thresholds that need to be calibrated to understand the impact in a broader sense.
Great, thanks. And Sue, I'll ask a similar question to you as well. When you're working with institutions like IFC and IDB Invest, how do you emphasize impact and financial viability?
So I'm going to answer that in a couple of ways. First of all, to state that this actually is one of the challenging elements, because of course, what is seen is that we have investments that, unlike our usual development type projects, which might last 3 to 5 years, we're often looking in the climate space at projects that will run 15 to 25 years. And so you're really trying to think ex ante of what sort of results can you expect and what kind of indicators can you put that will reliably measure those. And I'll be really honest and say that another one of the challenges is that what is seen is a large pool of money going into, for example, an MDB, like, for example, you know, our IFC partnership. But it's very difficult then sometimes to see the sub projects that come out of that, because that's really where the funding is starting to go and actually do the types of investments that have impact on real people on the ground. And so that's actually a really live dialogue that we have now with our MDB counterparts. How do we actually get better at looking across these timelines, taking the kind of projects that are first off the mark, understanding what's happening on the ground, and starting to bring those kind of results back? Because we know that Canadians, from citizens to parliamentarians, they want to know just what that money is actually doing to make an impact on the ground.
Great, thanks. Elizabeth, somewhat of a similar or evolving question to that is, you know, over the last couple of days, we've heard about the role of technical assistance and the role that it can play in helping vulnerable countries or maybe larger projects, riskier projects. What is your perspective on the government's role in providing some of that soft funding for technical assistance and design funding?
Yeah, thanks for raising that question. I think it's really important to think through this. So Treasury has an Office of Technical Assistance, and it's been around for a while, and it's really an effective tool for Treasury to be able to support partner governments where they work. So the idea is that they have experts who are embedded in the finance ministry, in the central bank, in some other finance ministries potentially, to assist with things like fiscal reform, budgetary work. But then also on the, if you're thinking about climate finance, placing the first green bond or working through climate budgeting. You know, there are certain things that you can do as sort of the standard vanilla financial support. And then there are ways that you can integrate climate elements. And that is precisely what our Office of Technical Assistance is considering right now, is how to do that more and more. So I would say there's that element that's direct from the United States. USAID similarly has technical assistance capabilities and other US agencies. But then also, obviously, the multilateral development banks do too. And I have to say that, you know, just adding a little bit of grant resources can go so, you know, can really go a long way, because that can sort of help to expand the capacity on the ground to make the project work. And sometimes it just takes a little bit. Sometimes it takes more. But it is really important to be able to offer that as a tool as you consider some of the investments that are going into you know, lower income countries where capacity may or may not be constrained, or emerging markets where they want to try something new, say, and just need a little bit of assistance to help figure it out.
Great, thank you. And Ambassador Fuller, similar question to you. We have a number of Canadian companies that I work with as a trade commissioner that would benefit from technical assistance. Where do you see the role of technical assistance overall, and where what resources could we point companies to for technical assistance? And Sue, if you have some thoughts on it too, love to get your comments as well.
Yeah, I think I'm going to pass that one straight to Sue Fahim, because that's okay. Really her world. So.
Oh, darn, Patricia, I was hoping you would jump into that one. Okay, so this one is a really challenging one for us. On the one hand, we have some typical ways in which we provide technical assistance alongside some of our multilateral development bank funding. And we also support some organizations that are very specifically geared towards capacity building, mostly with countries, and supporting them also to be able to access the climate finance that is out there, recognizing the architecture for many countries, particularly poorer and smaller countries, can be quite bewildering to actually navigate. I think where we are still trying to figure out a way forward, and quite actively, is figuring out how we can use official development assistance in ways that actually can support Canadian companies, for example. Because we're very concerned about making sure we keep to untied aid and official development assistance rules. And so I'll just again state that, you know, it is something that we continue to try to figure out what are the best ways in which we can actually try to address some of these technical assistance types of needs.
Okay. And Aparna, you had mentioned that DFC has technical assistance. Can you comment on how you decide where technical assistance is deployed?
Sure. Yes. Yeah, so our technical assistance, especially the fund that we've just launched, the $50 million that we've earmarked specifically for climate-focused technical assistance, is really to try to build up a pipeline of projects that we can eventually invest in. So ideally, I mean, there doesn't need to be a direct line as the absolute next, very next step. But as long as a project can show that there is potential for the DFC to support this project in the future, that's where we have the technical assistance available. And this is, you know, this has ranged in the past from like environmental impact assessments and whatnot. But right now, I think given our focus on expanding our thematic you know, the thematic sectors that we're looking to bolster. This will probably require, you know, supporting the development of adaptation and resilience projects that are actually bankable, because that, as we know, is one of the biggest gaps that we have in the broader climate finance landscape. So I see that as probably a key. I anticipate adaptation and resilience being a key target for us in with regards to our fund. But it's really, broadly speaking, it's really looking to help build a pipeline to feed into our climate portfolio.
Thank you. Ambassador Fuller, when you had mentioned in your comments about developing countries taking on an unfair burden to climate, and as they're developing out their NDCs, how is Canada and how are we advising them or working with them to provide fair NDCs that are actually could be achievable?
Well, the N in the NDC is really important. And the crux of the Paris Agreement was that these be nationally determined. That was an important difference with the previous attempts at climate negotiations. So we don't want to detract from that. At the end of the day, the targets have to be nationally determined, but we have to, as a community, as a global community, work together to have those targets add up to a total that makes the temperature goal achievable. And right now we're quite far off what's required to meet the 1.5 degree. We're still at something like 3 or above 3 in terms of existing commitments. So for sure, we need to see those commitments strengthened. Obviously, it's the major emitters that matter the most. And so, you know, the G20 is an important grouping there in terms of where we need to see increases in ambition. So I think that's very much where the conversation is around ambition, around that broader kind of point, though, of burden sharing and recognition that developing countries are bearing the brunt of the impact for two reasons. One is often geographic location, but the other is just the capacity to make the investments required to build resilience. So that's where there's really a recognition that we need a stronger emphasis on adaptation in climate finance. That's something that Canada is certainly thinking about. And I don't know if you'll permit me, Fahim, to throw out a question myself to my colleagues on this panel, but I think it would be really interesting to hear from Aparna, and perhaps Elizabeth has thoughts as well. Is one thing that I know Sue and others in Canada have been, I think we're all challenged by is of course, we recognize the importance of grant-based support for adaptation, but we could obviously greatly increase the resources available for adaptation if we can also develop more and better models for loan-based approaches to adaptation that don't involve increasing debt burdens. In other words, private sector partnerships. So I'd love to hear from perhaps Aparna in particular about what's working in that space around adaptation, where it's clearly harder to get private sector investors because you don't have an obvious, you know, revenue source for projects the way you do for energy, for example. So that would be interesting.
Sure, Aparna, would you like to respond?
Yeah, and that's an important question. Thank you for raising it. I think one thing I want to be fully transparent about is I'm on week 3 of this new role, and so I can't probably speak, you know, in great detail to DFC's former efforts in adaptation investment specifically. But what I will say is that there, you know, I think adaptation financing that can genuinely attract private sector capital seems to be the million, or rather billion, you know, billions of dollar question at the moment, right? And figuring out, you know, given that you cannot monetize the adaptation benefits as easily, how we can be bringing in, you know, the right sources of capital is really essential. Outside of the DFC example, the one other point that I would want to highlight is that the Global Commission on Adaptation has been doing some really interesting research in highlighting projects that have integrated green and gray infrastructure for resilient building development and resilient infrastructure development as a way of showing the adaptation capacity of nature-based solutions that has actually indeed attracted private sector capital already. So I know that they have a few examples that we could turn to, but you'll have to excuse me for not being able to speak to DFC's full portfolio just yet.
Elizabeth, did you have anything to add?
This is the billion-dollar question. It's such a good one. I think, a couple of things that we are thinking through. Of course, we support a couple of disaster risk insurance facilities, right? And so these are insurance facilities that are sort of public, private. They intend to help developing countries buy insurance products that are that they may not be able to finance, without a little bit of assistance. And that definitely is some way to get to climate adaptation. I would say, in the agriculture sector, that is potentially one opportunity as well. I am, as of this week, but not next week, the U.S. board member to the International Fund for Agricultural Development, based in Rome, and it targets smallholder farmers. And they're thinking more and more about what work can be done with the private sector to integrate supply chains for smallholder farmers. Now, the question then leads to, loans versus grants. There are different markets that you can make investments in where loans would be appropriate, but the debt burden question is a rising concern. And coming out of the economic shock of the post COVID period, that will remain an issue. So I don't have the full answer, but let's continue talking about it.
Great.
If I can jump in with an additional remark there, I think the question of insurance, I think, is a really interesting one, right? I know that even as DFC, we have we've contributed and invested in the Inter-Resilience Global Partnership, and their Solutions Fund specifically that's providing insurance access to smallholder farmers. But my question in with regards to the insurance industry is that if you can't afford to pay for the premiums, how can you ensure that financial risk is indeed transferred? And how can we ensure that coverage? So these are really important questions. And I think I'm excited for us to be working on this.
Yeah, it underscores the need for collaboration between public and private to try and figure that out. We have a number of questions that have come in, but I am going to take moderator's privilege and say, ask one more as a culminating thought before we move over to Q&A. So it's an optimistic question, I like to think. So what does success look like for climate in 2050? And what are the one or two climate finance interventions that we need to get there? So Elizabeth, I'll start with you.
Okay, so just to have the question, repeat the question back to make sure I understand. So what are the one or two interventions to get to the 2050 goal?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that it's going to have to come with a concerted effort. I think that there will absolutely need to be collaboration among partners like the collaboration that the United States and Canada have to make sure that the NDCs are as strong as possible in our own countries, in our partner countries, and that those plans, that our domestic strategies, are then supported by the financial flows that need to come. So that could come in the form of development assistance. It can come in the form of private investment. It's going to have to be all of the above. So I think, focusing on the NDCs and the financial flows, those would be the two.
Great. Perna?
A great question. I think it's tough to boil it down to just two. But I think, one of the key key points is just collaboration, right? We have to figure out how we can better work together, whether it is figuring out how we can get more grant funding that can lead to other types of financing without increasing debt burdens, you know, whether it is the insurance solutions that are incredibly important, but making sure that they are actually reaching the most vulnerable as well. So I think collaboration is super key, whether it is, you know, across countries, but or across sectors. So I'd say that is number one, and probably number two as well. Collaboration. And adaptation, actually. There we go.
Okay. Ambassador Fuller?
Yeah, I would say that it's bringing that collaboration to the country level. I think, you know, for sure, to make this transformation, I referred already to the high level of cooperation that's needed among all the players, but we really need to bring it down to the country level. And I think that's where the COP work is making important progress through things like the Energy Transition Council, where they're having these in-country dialogues, and that's creating a conversation among donors and host governments and other actors around how to collaborate against that goal, as Elizabeth described, of enabling them to increase their ambition. So that's for sure an important part of the what it'll take to get there.
And Sue?
Okay, with it being rather unfair to go last, you know, and of course I agree with all the excellent remarks made by the previous panelists. So what do we need to do? I'm going to say scale and distribution. Scale, first of all, to act on the evidence that coal is the significant hurdle that we have to get over. On a planetary scale, like how do we do a big push in terms of coal abatement? And then in terms of distribution, you know, our goals on climate change and climate finance cannot be at the cost of society and leaving people behind. So we need a new normal in investment. Investment needs to look at integrating the just transition, ESG, and inclusion in every way in which we work.
Great. Thank you. So we have time for maybe one or two more questions. And so I'll just try and sort of consolidate some of the themes around these questions. One of the questions, you know, people have some really good ideas on climate adaptation projects and climate mitigation projects. They can be a little bit high risk. One example is Lake Kivu in DRC. And so the question here is, how can project developers who are looking to develop these sort of very impactful but high risk projects, where can they turn to get the financial support they need? Maybe that means, you know, going into getting grants and softer capital at the beginning. So I'll throw it out there, and whoever sort of wants to answer that, that can be our first question.
So maybe I'll jump in on this. And I think it, you know, it shows why, one of the reasons why we often work through the multilateral development banks, because they're also able to construct portfolios that can balance out lower risk and higher risk. And coming back to the point about why is there that risk in the first place? Some of these countries, the policy framework, the regulatory frameworks, you know, are the things that are underlying some of that risk. It's country level risk that is overriding some of the project level risk. And in that sense, you know, just to return to one of the themes, I think, in this panel of how do we work better together to try to bring down through a coordinated effort some of those risks in some of these poorer, more vulnerable countries.
No, I think just echoing that we need that addressing risks like that really does require a collaborative approach to really try to access, to try to bring different types of capital together. And I think there's been some very lively, engaged discussions in the interagency here on figuring out how we can develop blended finance platforms that can address these issues regionally.
Okay. Elizabeth, I'll ask this question to you, but anybody can answer this because I think it's an interesting one. It seems to me that loans and financing are a preferred approach to support clean tech initiatives. How can we ensure that the results are measured consistently and in comparable ways? What are the requirements that company subsidies that are standardized between the US and Canada?
So I'm going to leave the subsidy question to the side for a second, because that's not Treasury International Affairs remit. But I think, you know, it's an important point that when it comes to clean technology, often, at least through the multilateral system, there is sort of a view that these are projects that might be more financially sustainable, and so they can take loans. They may be more in, you know, upper middle income countries, potentially, not always, of course. And so in those instances, it may be more appropriate to finance them with loans, but that's not always the case. And I have to say that, you know, the MDBs do have tools to be able to, you know, sort of augment the financing package with other things to make these projects viable, whether it's political risk insurance or offering, you know, loans in local currency, or, you know, there are a number of other tools to make them viable. And it's not just a sort of grants versus loans argument for how to make the project work.
I don't know, Sue, did you have any thoughts on that as well, on sort of how you measure those standards?
I think I would just, you know, add that the blended finance principles are ones that we adhere to. I mean, there's issues there around, you know, what's the appropriate level of minimum concessionality, additionality. And we all try, I think, to make sure that we apply those when we are making our investments, because that's one way, again, they're at a very high level, but with ways to calculate them. And that's one way to ensure that we're bringing a common principled and measurement approach across different investments.
So with that, I'm going to close the session. I'd like to thank our panel for such a great conversation. I think that we all have a better sense of what the Canadian and American commitments to climate are and what it means to finance positive change when it comes to climate. So it's clear here that, as it was in the last sessions, that there must be strong coordination and partnership between climate project investors, entrepreneurs, governments, and funding mechanisms so that we have policy that supports innovative finance, which supports investors, which supports entrepreneurs, and really instigates positive change. So thank you, everyone, for being a part of the panel.